Welcome to the Fierce Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love. Today, we are joined by Dr. Susan Hansen, professor of history at the University of Dallas. Dr. Hansen will be sharing with us how the American family is rooted in freedom. All right. Thank you, Dr. Hansen, so much for being on our show today.
I'm so glad to be here with you.
So we are talking about freedom this month. And if anyone's ever taken your class before, if we have any listeners who have taken your class before, you always start your class with this timeline. And it's, you know, you start with you are here and wherever our location is. And just kind of thinking about history and our freedom and our rights and just the family today. Can you share with us kind of how the American family has kind of gotten to where we are based on some of a more, I guess, abbreviated version of American history from the foundation of our country?
Right. Yeah. So I do. I like to start all of my classes at the University of Dallas, whether it's American civilization taught on the Dallas campus in Texas, or whether it's Western civilization taught on the University of Dallas's beautiful Rome campus, with the idea that you are here at a particular place in a particular time, and that all of us, in some sense, have a vocation to the time and place in which we have been placed, literally placed. And so the struggles that are the struggles of our culture are our struggles, and that it's kind of a privilege to be able to get to know the order of our civilization and the disorder in our civilization, and to be able to grapple with that and struggle with that. And so one of the things that I'm thinking right now, in the summer of 2024, which is an election year for us, about 20 years after the turn of the third Christian millennium, the year 2000, that John Paul II sort of prepared the church for, with the John Paul II generation, many of whom started families and launched big family projects. And so many of the younger generation are children of that dream of the John Paul II generation. So here we are about 20 years into the third Christian millennium, and we're in the United States of America during an election year. The Republican National Convention is going on as we speak. We've just heard yesterday evening that J.D. Vance, who is a Catholic convert, has just been made the vice presidential candidate. And I know that there's a lot of concern in this country about the cultural soil for families, right? And I think that that's something that J.D. Vance himself, with his book, Hillbilly Elegy, which was a autobiographical story about the difficulties that his own family went through, which was then made into a movie, also called Hillbilly Elegy, which talks a lot about broken families, the drug problem, drinking problems, breakup of the family, breakup of the communities that help to sustain families. I know that that kind of brings to the fore a lot of this anxiety for a lot of people about the situation of the family in American culture in 2024. But I also want to say that just coming back from teaching for the past 2 months on the campus over in Rome, that the University of Dallas has, I'm also vividly aware that the United States has a very healthy family culture in pockets, that there are communities in which there are really healthy families, and that we shouldn't lose track of that. We shouldn't lose sight of that, those points of hope, because they're really hope points of hope, not just for the United States of America, but for the whole world. Looking to us, yes, a lot of the world can see breakup of the family, but also looking to the American Catholic Church, there's a lot of health and hope to be given to the Universal Church. In fact, the prelate of Opus Dei, Don Fernando Ocatis, just said that the work of Opus Dei with families is going very well, particularly in the United States, in Brazil, and in Nigeria. So I was very moved that the United States was in company with the Brasileños and the Nigerians in having a very good, healthy family culture in many ways. So we have reasons to be concerned, but we also have a great deal of freedom in America to revitalize the cultural roots that are necessary for having good families. So I hope that our conversation can look both at some of the concerns, but also at some of the possibilities for hope. So I just wanted to give maybe a little bit a sense of three stages of the history of the American family. I teach American civilization, but I also teach a history of American women. And I think it's an unusual women's history class because it focuses very much on the role of women in families, which of course has been the life that most American women throughout our history have lived, is a life focused on their families. So I just wanted to give like a little bit of an overview so that people could think big picture about where the family has been in America and where the family is going in America. And so the three stages that I see are really the rural pre-Civil War period, the second stage being the stage of mass immigration and the creation of urban centers and most people living their lives in big cities. And then after World War II, the development of a suburban culture, right? So those are really the three stages that I would see. And those are also kind of important stages in American history more generally. So the 1850s, before the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln talks about the happy teeming millions. The happy teeming millions of people, particularly living in the Midwest. He really sees Ohio and Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan as the heartland of America. This is where there are these great farming families, these pioneer communities that we associate with Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie, and these farming communities that are very close-knit. And one of the characteristics that I want to highlight about those communities is that very often they had a sense of mission above and beyond simply the prosperity of their own family, simply the, you know, they weren't thinking in terms of upward mobility. They were thinking in terms of preservation of a family culture. Tim Carney has a wonderful book called Alienated America, where he talks about a lot of these communities. He has a more recent book called Family Unfriendly, Why American Culture Makes It So Hard for Families. But Tim Carney's earlier book called Alienated America focuses on these kind of older communities that were formed in the 19th century, particularly in the Midwest, that had a sense of mission, right? Whether it was Polish Catholics or Dutch Calvinists, right, who were creating local communities that were really driven by a sense of purpose and mission to preserve a particular form of culture, right? They weren't just make it rich communities, right? They weren't just lone individuals on the frontier trying to, you know, make it. These were not, you know, cowboys or gold diggers. These were family communities who were really trying to sustain a particular family culture. And so you see, for example, in the Texas Hill Country, in the German, Polish, and Czech Catholic farming communities, there's still a vibrant cultural attachment to certain ways of cooking, to having, you know, fairs, dances, you know. And so, you know, Tim Carney is saying these communities have actually survived very well all of the devastation that community has faced in the 20th century. So that's worth looking at and remembering that that's a part of our heritage that we can go back to, that we can teach our children and we can learn from. So that's what I would call stage one, right? Rural America, 1850s, like pre-Civil War America, farming communities. And of course, there are a lot of people who are kind of looking back to this with the homesteading movement, people, you know, thinking of themselves as being kind of Benedict optioners, you know, getting outside of the Beltway or getting away from, you know, the big sprawl, and trying to create self-sustaining communities again. So there is that ideal still, just as there was in the 1830s with a lot of Catholic back to the land efforts. So the next stage really introduced something new in American history. I would say the stage from 1872 to 1925, which is the stage of mass migration into the United States, most of it Catholic, most of it coming from Latin and Southern Central and Eastern European countries. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, a lot of Slavs, whether it's Croatians, Serbians, Poles, Ukrainians. So there was a huge shift in migration. It wasn't any longer primarily from the British Isles, but it was primarily coming from Catholic countries. And they were not primarily moving out to these farming communities of the Midwest. Many of them were so poverty-stricken in Europe that they were not able to afford land. And they just settled down in the developing cities and got jobs in factories. So just at the time when the American economy was shifting from a rural and agricultural economy in the 19th century to a manufacturing and commercial economy in the 20th century, this mass migration provided workers for that movement. And so that's when, for the first time in the 1920s, the majority of Americans started living in cities. And that had not been true before the 1920s. And so the experience of family in a city, right, is a new experience for America at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think that there's pros and cons, right, to American life in the city. And you have those pockets, whether it's, you know, Little Italy or the Irish south side of the tracks in Chicago, right? These close-knit, you think of like, you know, Chinatown or whatever, these close-knit urban communities, you know, sometimes they're referred to as ghettos and, you know, produce a kind of ghetto mentality. But at the same time, there's a very close-knit community going on there, which is sometimes idealized in movies like My Big Fat Greek Wedding or Return to Me or something like that, you know, like where there are these close-knit families, right, that are kind of idealized by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who have kind of lost that sense of the larger community beyond the little nuclear family. So that's a very important time in American history when Catholic immigration was really sustaining the enormous population growth, both by immigration and by birth rate, because the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant birth rate had already started to plummet in the 1870s. Also, the African-American birth rate had started to plummet in the 1870s. And so the birth rate was really being sustained by this wave of Catholic immigration. So that's the second stage, and I'd like to talk about that more later, but just to move on to the third stage, kind of quickly to get the whole picture out first. The third stage is coming out of the Depression, coming out of World War II, America becoming a superpower and growing in prosperity, and you get this enormous suburban sprawl. Right. So you've gone from rural to urban and now to suburban. The goal for the American family is home ownership. The goal for the American family is car ownership. There's much more the possibility of moving for a higher paying job, upward mobility out of the cities and into the suburbs. And so families are moving further and further apart from each other. You have the GI Bill making it possible for a lot more people to go to college, but that also means that people are traveling for college. And so they're further away from their families, maybe meeting someone from another side of the country and settling down elsewhere for a job. So you'd have sort of one generation living on the East Coast, then maybe going to a Midwestern school like Notre Dame, meeting someone from the West Coast and trying to find a job, you know, who knows where. And so while in some sense, the suburban ideal of the 1950s with the home, with the car, in the nice neighborhood, the grass, the tree lined neighborhood is idyllic in some ways. It's also a time of new forces. I would say the forces of mobility, both economic and geographical mobility, which are kind of ripping the family apart as well. So that's just a very basic, I haven't gotten down to sort of brass tacks there, but just to give people a very basic overview, I think, of the history of the American family that might give them some way of placing themselves and their own family's history in a larger story. Right. Yes, we, each of us can go on ancestry.com or 23andMe and find our personal family history. But sometimes it's good to look at it on the tapestry of family history in America writ large.
Yes, perfect. And I love that you gave that image because, right, like you said, it can be hard to like think of it as a historical, like we're in our own historical movement. So in thinking of that first stage, the second stage and the third stage, how would you say that the role of the family, what that looked like in all three of those stages, how would you say that has changed? You mentioned already like being more separated, all those things growing apart. I guess what I would ask is, the role of the American family, how is that, let's say, how's that unique according, yeah, like in with keeping in mind that those three parts, yeah, that you told us about history?
Well, I think the American family, both in the 19th century with the great evangelical awakening. So you have the Great Awakening in the 1700s and then the Second Great Awakening in the 1800s, the evangelical awakening in Protestant circles, definitely gives the family a kind of what I described larger mission, larger than itself mission, right? So that the goal of the family is not simply its own prosperity or its own upward mobility, right? But that the family is at the service of something larger than that. And I think that you even see that in the immigrant communities in the 19th century, with the development of the parochial school system in the Catholic communities, which is absolutely a kind of world historical special achievement, right? You had poor Irish immigrants, poor German immigrants who were opting out of the newly developed free public school system in order to create parochial schools, parish schools that would help them to sustain their faith and their faith community at their own expense. So they're paying taxes for public schools, but at the same time, they're paying to the parishes to educate their children in the faith. So in both of those cases, right, in the evangelical Protestant circles and in the Catholic immigrant circles in the 19th century, you see this mission-driven, faith-driven family, right, which is trying to achieve something greater than simply its own prosperity or its own upward mobility. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I really see as part of that healthy picture that Lincoln admires, the happy teeming millions, right, when it was very typical for families to have 10 to 20 children. And sometimes we associate this primarily with rural communities and agricultural communities. You know, you're sort of producing your own workers for the farm. Mm-hmm. But there's more to it than that, right? There is very much the idea of raising up children for God. And this vivid sense that children do belong to the parents, but they don't only belong to the parents. That you're raising up, as it says in the Old Testament, you know, raising up progeny for the Lord. And that kind of language was common to both Protestant and Catholic populations in the 19th century. Then moving into the second period, I think one of the things that's very noticeable is a kind of bifurcation between what I'm calling the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. And I would there emphasize particularly not so much the evangelical churches, but the mainline churches, the Episcopalian and Presbyterian and Lutheran churches, and the Catholic immigration. You get a kind of bifurcation, and two different things are happening in the family simultaneously. And so this is when you get in the mainline Protestant churches, a little bit of racism, a little bit of the contraceptive mentality, a little bit of that eugenics mentality that we really see coming to the fore in the Nazi movement, of concern about these darker peoples from, you know, Latin countries or from, you know, Eastern and Southern Europe. And so you start to get a conversation at the beginning of the 20th century about contraception. So at first, when contraceptive methods were being explored, at first the feminist movement is very opposed to them, and they work to get anti-obscenity laws on the books so that you couldn't advertise contraceptive devices. But gradually, this racist and eugenic contraceptive mentality, right, becomes a part of, I would say, the white elite of America. And, you know, so there's a real tension there in the 1930s, 1920s, 1930s. You see this going on both in Great Britain, Germany, and in the United States. The rise of this kind of contraceptive mentality in some of the population, which is why I emphasize that the population growth, not just by immigration, but by a healthy birth rate, was mostly sustained during those years by the Catholic population, mm-hmm. Which was significantly contributing to the overall prosperity of America. Mm-hmm. Then in the third period, you have to look at the, in the third period, the post World War II period, where you have this move into the suburbs, the home ownership, car ownership, a little bit more of this emphasis on prosperity and upward mobility. And this goes along with the invention of the contraceptive pill, the legalization of the pill, and a kind of broad acceptance of the pill in Protestant and Catholic America, which has, you know, really transformed our birth rate. Our birth rate has been dropping ever since the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. Yes, there's a little bit of a baby boom during World War II and the kind of euphoria of victory in the war and post-war prosperity. But is really a blip on an overall trajectory downwards of births across the entire 20th century. Mm-hmm. People will sometimes talk about a baby boomlet at the beginning of the 21st century, but that's even smaller than the baby boom of the World War II period. And really statistically and demographically does not change the downward movement there. So I think that that's something that anyone who's thinking about the family has to be aware that we are, whether economically or culturally, socially, we're creating a culture which is not a culture of life. It's not promoting a healthy birth rate, a birth rate that can even sustain or replace itself. Yeah. So that's a big time story for the family.
Yeah. Well, and like, so just looking at this whole progression, it seems like the pendulum has been up here and now it's swinging. Do you think now in 2024, where do you see us going? Yeah. Because as the American family, because I mean, yes, it sounds very sad, you know, the birth rate's dropping and declining. And, but then you hear the stories of people trying to go homestead or trying to do things that are kind of where we began as a country. Do you think that that will have a positive effect going forward, or do you think it's going to take some time?
Well, I think America is very bifurcated, right? It's very divided at the moment between people who still have a kind of euphoria about progress and technology and think that any technological problem we create can be solved by some technological solution. And what goes along with that is technologizing our bodies, right? You can technologize fertility out of people, right? And of course, this has really come to a head with the whole transgender movement, where you're literally not just hormonally shutting down women's fertility, but you're also surgically mutilating children to make it impossible for them ever to have children in the future. So you still have part of our population that has this kind of 19th century mentality of all technology is progress, right? And anything we can do, we should be allowed to do. Like, if you can shoot someone up with transgender hormones, then you should be allowed to do that, right? But I think there's a large part of our population, Protestant and Catholic, and non-believing, who have really embraced like the natural rhythms of the human person and recognize that when you try to technologize biology, when you try to technologize the human person, right, that you're really destroying more than creating, destroying our capacities rather than facilitating and enhancing our capacities. And so I do think that there's a kind of bifurcation between those who still believe in that kind of movement and those who really see the freedom in America not as a freedom to do whatever we want with technology, even to ourselves, but the freedom to be able to create self-governing communities at the local level, at the state level, even through through federal legislation, that it's really the right to self-govern in ways that are humane and promote human flourishing. So I wouldn't see this as like liberal and conservative. I think in some sense they're two different visions of liberty. Right. One is a kind of libertarian, you can do anything. And the other one is ordered liberty, liberty that's ordered to the flourishing of the human person, which I think is more in line with the thinking of the American founders, who always tied liberty also to happiness. And their understanding of happiness was definitely tied to an understanding of the laws of nature and of nature's God, to take a phrase from the Declaration of Independence. I think there's still hope, we're standing on a precipice. We're standing on the kind of edge of a chasm, and we can, as a culture, we can go either way. I think many wise souls in the past have said, sin is new, evil is new in every generation. It's not going anywhere, right? But freedom is also new in every generation. I don't think we're inevitably going in one direction or the other. I think it really is up to the choice of the next generation.
Great. And speaking of the next generation, what can parents do? What can families do to kind of encourage that, kind of going back to that mission sense of how, like, our families have a sense of mission? How can parents help foster that in their own families?
Yeah. So I think two things in particular. One is prioritizing family connections in every decision that we make. So whether it's college, whether it's jobs, whether it's moving, whether it's getting a new house, whether it's getting a new car, prioritizing family questions, family connections in every decision that we make. I was very blessed growing up with some very stalwart aunts, right? my mother's sisters, and these ladies, you know, they knew how to sustain family. They devoted themselves completely to homemaking, and the education of their children. They devoted themselves completely to Sunday dinners, to family gatherings on the 4th of July and Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter. And that commitment that they had to big family gatherings, you know, where there's more kids than grownups, and so a fair amount of chaos and, you know, destruction of your nicely ordered home. their commitment to those family gatherings over the course of their lifetime has created another generation that is also very committed to getting together with cousins to go camping, getting together with, you know, cousins for a hiking trip. We used to always, you know, one day in the fall, my mother and my aunts would just say, you know, today is hooky day and we're all going to go hiking in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And you never knew when that day was, but you woke up and suddenly you were piling in the family van with the cousins, you know, to go hiking and see the fall foliage. And that was just spectacular. So prioritizing family and living near family, even if it means, you know, other aspects of life are not, you know, ideal, because families really create a kind of aristocracy. It just is true that when you have intact families in one generation, it helps to create intact families in the next generation. And intact families give you a social network. Intact families give you economic opportunities. Intact families give you example of models of virtue and resilience that will be very valuable in so many episodes in life. So prioritizing family, I would say. And then secondly, always realizing that that the father in the family, that the mother in the family, right, are not the primary parents of the children, that the primary parents of the children are always God, is always God, right? The 18th century, our founding fathers, they had a wonderful phrase that they used to use all the time. They would refer to God as the great parent of the universe, right? As you know, you can kind of hear them rolling their R's in a kind of 18th century English, you know, speech, but John Adams and Abigail Adams, the figures of the 18th century in their correspondence, when they refer to God, they always refer to him as the great parent of the universe, mm-hmm. right? And so this is very important for parents to always remember that children are not theirs. Mm-hmm. Children belong first and foremost to God. That children are not accessories or possessions to do with what we want. And that we have to raise up children to God, because we're only ever procreators of children. We're never the creators of children. You know, our founding fathers had it very clear. The Christians who founded this country had it very clear that while we may help to create the body, only God creates the soul, and the soul is the most important part of the person. Having that sense of mission, that's really what family is about, is raising up souls for God, is a very important, it's a very important balance. Because if you focus so much on family, but you think of family as your own little project or your own little possession or your own little accessory to your lifestyle, right? Then that's not healthy either. And that needs to be balanced, by the idea that God is the primary father of every family.
Wonderful. Beautiful. So there's a lot of current events that are happening right now that have been pretty intense in our American history, I think. And how would you suggest kind of parents going about discussing with their children what's happening now, in the light of history, in the light of our nation, to keep, to help them to see the importance of it, you know, not just kind of pushing it aside, because I think history is extremely important for us to understand what's happening now. But how, I mean, obviously different ages, but let's say there's a child who's seen the news, and how would you suggest parents kind of going and discussing the current events and then also referring back to, you know, our history?
So strangely enough, while we might think of this as something that we're facing primarily in the 21st century with the ubiquity of the news and the ubiquity of cell phones and this like age of intense information and intense images, always being bombarded by images, this is actually something that Alexis de Tocqueville, the French travel writer who came to the United States in the 1840s, was already writing about with regard to American families, that he was very intrigued by the style of education that he saw going on in the American family. And two things he points to. He calls the American family very democratic and affectionate, as opposed to patriarchal or tribal and formal or a legal reality. It's much more of a social reality, that there's an ease of affection between husband and wife, between parents and children, between siblings, a little bit less hierarchical, aristocratic, patriarchal, or tribal. And so he sees that ease of conversation between parents and children as fostering. The second thing that he finds very interesting about the American family is, and he talks about this particularly with regard to young women and the education of young women in America, the education of the young girl in America. He has a chapter on that that's worth reading. He says, it is inevitable that a young woman, it is inevitable that children will see a great deal of evil in a society in which everything is done out in the open, everything is done out in public, right? We don't all live in little family, you know, patriarchal family communes or in, you know, gated communities, right? Everything's out there to be seen. He's already saying this in the 1840s, right? That this is a new kind of culture that they're seeing, and that it's very important, he says, that the Americans little by little unveil the world to the young and don't just teach them virtue, but also teach them to recognize vice and to be able to fortify themselves against it. He says it's much better to fortify them interiorly against vice than to hide vice from them or to protect them by keeping it, you know, far away and at bay. It makes for interesting reading, right? And I know that that could be really controversial. And I, you know, maybe that's something that watchers of this podcast could, you know, get together and read that section of Alexis de Tocqueville on the education of the American girl and kind of extrapolate more broadly to the education of children in these difficult times. And have a conversation about the balance, you know, that you want to preserve innocence, but at the same time, you need to fortify them against vice. But that means letting them know about evil, which is a very hard balance to get. Again, I go back to the importance of mothers devoting themselves entirely to the home and to the education of their children. Value for the homemaker and full-time mother, you know, vocation, I think is really necessary, because that's a pair of eyes that's 24/7 on what's going on in the home and also what's going on in the faces and the eyes of their children, to know, you know, how to strike that balance, because that balance is going to be different for every child. That balance is going to be different for every family. And, you know, you have to have an intelligence worker before you can make executive decisions. And the mother's the intelligence worker. She's the one who kind of knows what's going on, you know, if she's really, you know, 100% full time observing, you know, what the children need.
Great. And actually, it's funny that you mentioned the book Alexis de Tocqueville, because I just got this really nice version of that book of Democracy in America. And I started reading that section because I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's a little different. But it's
people should realize that Alexis de Tocqueville is huge, two volumes, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Mm-hmm. But each chapter is very short. Mm-hmm. And you can look up topics in the chapters and then just read a super short, almost just a paragraph or two paragraph long chapter of Alexis de Tocqueville, mm-hmm. On a topic that interests you. So it's a very handy handbook to American culture, written by a Frenchman in the 1840s of all things, but it does make for great reading. And yes, that section on the American wife, mm-hmm. And how the American woman is very resilient, moving from poverty to prosperity and back to poverty again and back to prosperity again, and basically able to live either, you know, with aplomb. And then the education of the American girl, I have always found very interesting. I love to teach those in my American women's history class.
That. Do you have any other recommendations for historical literature or even primary sources that parents could read that would help them just kind of better have a better understanding of our history or even the family?
Yeah. Two that stand out to me. Actually, I have a lot. I'm a college professor, so I got lots of books on, you know, but there is, there's this book called The Diary of Martha Ballard. And Martha Ballard was a midwife in the 1770s, so right around the same time as the American Revolution. And a Harvard women's historian, Laurel Fetcher Ulrich, who is a Mormon and mother of six herself, I believe, kind of deciphered this midwife's diary. And it's just an incredible tale. It's an incredible story of her work in a small community and getting to know the families of that community, working basically as a nurse practitioner and midwife. That's also available as a video. So you can look up Laurel Fetcher Ulrich, The Diary of Martha Ballard. Mm-hmm. And I think just that centrality of the women's network around childbirth, mm-hmm. And how beautiful that is. I think Laurel Fetcher Ulrich has really looked at that with the best kind of feminist eye, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that this is such a women's contribution to the strength of a community. So that's one. And then a little bit more easy to read and colloquial, easy to find, is your little Lauren Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie books, starting with Little House in the Big Woods. I think that people underestimate that children's literature, underestimate it and don't realize how well composed, how well thought out those books are. For example, Little House in the Big Woods literally teaches the four primary virtues as it takes a young child through the four seasons, right? So as it's taking you through autumn, winter, spring, summer, it's also taking you through prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. And so it really is a teaching book, and it shows just how much of our primary moral education is taken care of in the family and can't be outsourced, right? That really it is, it's an intensive moral formation just in the family. I like to say, looking at my own sister's big families, I like to say, you're teaching them a pre-moral lesson just by having another baby sister or brother, because the moral lesson, the first moral lesson, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you, right? Basic fairness, do unto others, right? But the pre-moral lesson is that there are others.
Yeah.
If there aren't others, you never learn the next lesson, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So every time a new baby comes into the family, you're made more aware of the fact that you're not the only person in the universe, which is like morality 101.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay. Any final thoughts on the American family, on our history that you want to share with our audience?
Well, I think as Americans, we should be aware that we come from a long line of strong women. Mm. And, you know, whether it's Abigail Adams or Harriet Beecher Stowe or Laura Ingalls Wilder, right? You know, we come from a long line of strong women. They have contributed a lot to sustaining a family culture through times when we really see family culture breaking up. And so that we should be proud of that heritage, and we should teach that heritage to our daughters.
Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovesshrine.org.